Hi, Rob.
Hi, Brian.
It's great to have you here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a little while now. You're a good friend of mine. We met through the Interintellect, first, I think, online, and then in person in London. We had lots of great dinners, lots of great chats. Now we are remote from each other. And yeah, it's been a good few years that we've been thinking in the same territory, but I think this is the first time we've actually recorded something together.
That's right, I think it is. And yeah, it's been kind of like 3 or 4 years. I think we probably met during the through the II during the pandemic when it was illegal to meet in person. And so
Yes.
everything had to be online. And then eventually it became legal to meet in person, and so we eventually did. But yeah, we have both been thinking about very similar things. And kind of often, as you often see, like on a parallel path in one sense, and yet at the same time, finding very different things, discovering very different things along the way.
So one thing I might do is just give a quick overview of my introduction to Buddhism and meditation and what I mean by some of these things, and then I'd ask you to do the same, if that's okay.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, so I started meditating about 5 or 6 years ago on the recommendation of a psychiatrist, actually. I started with Headspace and quite quickly encountered territory that is not well described in Headspace, which were concentration states or jhanas. And so I was having these kind of intense experiences and just asking all my friends, do you know what's happening to me? And some of them sort of wanted to potentially section me or something, but others basically at some point I got in touch with a friend of a friend who sort of knew what I was going through or what I now think I was going through. And they recommended me actually Daniel Ingram's book, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. And so that was one of my early introductions. And alongside that, I took Robert Wright's course that he was doing on Coursera at the time. He ended up eventually writing a book called Why Buddhism is True, which is a good introduction. But at that time, I think he was just kind of giving an overview of Buddhism. So I had those kind of intros. And Ingram, for people who don't know, I think he's more on the Vipassana side of practice, and so early Buddhism, and we can get into a little bit about those divisions maybe in more detail. But that was my first introduction. I did a Goenka retreat, which is a 10-day silent retreat, fairly early on in my meditation practice, maybe about a year into starting to meditate. I went through the Mind Illuminated and Mindfulness in Plain English and some of Mahasi Sayadaw's works. So these are mostly Theravada Vipassana techniques that I was looking at, which I hope we'll get into a little bit about what that means and how that might differ from other things. But that's been my overall practice. And then I think the final thing to add to that is just that I think it was August of last year, Lee Brasington was hosting an online meditation day, which was centered on his new book, which is called Sotapai, Streams of Dependently Arising Processes Interacting, I think is what the acronym means. But for short, it's called Dependent Origination and Emptiness. And that was my first sort of, it's the first time that I encountered this concept of Buddhism, which we'll probably also get into, called dependent origination, in a way that I thought it had any kind of practical implications, because it's a core part of all areas of Buddhism, but it's not always that easy to understand what you're supposed to do with this knowledge, I suppose. So, yeah, that was sort of the end of last year. From that point on, I got more and more interested in dependent origination. I ended up writing an article about it, sort of start of November. And I more recently spoke to Lee Brasington, and I've read a few more books on it, and I've been practicing a style of meditation from my understanding of dependent origination. So I think that brings us to the present. And I would love to hear sort of what your journey has been like. Yeah.
So I think the parallel is it's kind of over about the same time period, so the last 5 or 6 years, and with some things in common. So I did spend a good while practicing the Mind Illuminated, for concentration meditation in particular, and that I thought was very, I mean, it's very precise. It gives you a lot of information, and it's very staged. So it gives you, what happens at stage one, what happens at stage two, what happens at stage three, and there can be some jumping around. Sometimes you'll get into stage three territory or even stage four territory when you're mostly at stage two. But you can generally see that progression as it goes. And I guess I was kind of both lazy and curious, so I found that structure to be quite restrictive. And also I knew there was this whole thing called Vipassana or insight meditation, which isn't mentioned at all. And there's kind of some people who say, well, if you get to high enough levels of concentration, like the insight just starts to happen by itself. But I was kind of curious as to what that was all about. And also I just wanted to understand what the whole thing was, where it was going. So I also read Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha by Daniel Ingram. And again, he gives a whole bunch of he gives like a really good overview, not just of his own preferred approach, but his like 15 other ways that people do it that he thinks are inferior to his approach, because of course like that's otherwise he'd be doing one of those. But he gives a kind of a good account of why people try to do it that way, or what good it does them, and maybe what the limitations are. So that kind of made me realize that there is no one true way. There are lots of different traditions. And from there, I got really interested in actually was listening to Michael Taft's podcast, where he has a brilliant podcast with often people who've been spiritual practitioners of one kind or another for decades. So they're often people with really deep experience, often teachers, and there you just realize that like the diversity is enormous. There are lots and lots of people who do things in completely different ways. And again, I kind of developed like a deep interest in going down all of those rabbit holes. But then I also got curious about what's the comparative aspect here? How do we put these things alongside each other and kind of interrogate them? And basically that seems to be a thing that's not done in at least in sort of Western Buddhism to kind of really get comparative about it. And then I heard one of Michael's interviewees was Daniel Brown. And Daniel Brown sadly died last year, but was a teacher, but was also a psychiatrist and a psychologist for many, many decades, and a very respected figure in his own in his academic work. And he was being quite direct about it in a way that I thought was unusual. And so I got in touch with him, and I was fortunate enough to do a couple of retreats with him in the kind of Mahamudra, Tibetan Mahamudra style, which is different. Has some differences from the Theravada style. And in addition to that, I think he also introduced kind of conceptually the notion that you can compare these different fields, you can compare these different practices, I should say. And turns out he wrote back in the late 70s, he wrote three chapters of a book, or two chapters, with Ken Wilber on it was called Transformations of Consciousness. And I haven't read really very much Wilber. I know people have strong opinions about him, but I don't really have strong opinions. But in this book, he looks at three different progressive spiritual paths. One is a Theravada approach, one is a Mahamudra approach, and the third is basically following the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. So it's a Hindu practice, but one which is known to have some similarities to Buddhist practice, at least in the way that it's staged and sequenced. And his conclusion there was that if you look at what happens to people, it tends to be quite similar between the different the different paths. There are definitely these recognizable stages. They go through all of these different kind of insights. And the difference is not really down to which practices they do, but the difference is down to the view that they take while doing them. So it's essentially a kind of philosophical difference. And the view is something that is talked about a lot, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism. So the view is kind of, if you think of the purpose of meditation as being to deconstruct or to kind of free you, liberate you from your kind of conceptual framework, that's great. And that can lead to freedom from suffering and all kinds of other interesting consequences. But in order to function in the world, you do need to have some idea of what's going on. And just having everything collapse around you can be a little bit disorienting. So in that style, in the Tibetan Buddhist style, they do this in the Theravada as well, but there's a particular emphasis, I think, in Tibetan Buddhism. They're very explicit about the view. And that is essentially how you should see things, not which might be different from your kind of baseline. You'll always have a baseline view. If it's like an ideology, you know, you think you don't have one, but you do. Everybody has a view. But most people just have one that they acquired accidentally. And in this approach, you can be taught and you can be given philosophical explanations and you can be given, you know, analytical meditations to do even about the nature of reality or the nature of perception, the nature of things that you encounter. What are they? How do they work? How do you relate to them? What are you? And it gives you kind of a framework for then experiencing the fact that reality appears to be kind of strangely malleable. It appears to change and shift in ways that you normally don't expect. Like, you come in with a kind of naive realism. You come in thinking, well, I just see things because they're there. And after a bit of practice, you realize that that's not the whole story. You see things, but like, what you see depends a lot on your expectations. So you're not just seeing it because it's there, you're seeing it because you expected it to be there. You might be not seeing it because you didn't expect it to be there, and things like that. So in this, with this view, that kind of gives you your kind of like almost like cosmological kind of viewpoint on things, like your metaphysics, your kind of biggest picture framing of just like what the hell is going on. And that view is different in Theravada, is different in different schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's different in Hinduism.
Right.
So rather than there being kind of many different paths and they all lead you to the same place, which is kind of the perennialist philosophy, it's like the path is actually the same or pretty similar. But where you end up in terms of what you end up thinking of as being real is actually different in the different spiritual traditions. So.
Wow.
Kind of a Hindu practitioner, and even within Hinduism, there's great diversity. So, but someone following, for instance, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali will, if they adopt the view that is taught there, will end up experiencing the reality that accords with that philosophy. And if you do Mahamudra, you will experience the reality that accords with that philosophy. And I think the same could be said to be true for Christianity or Islam or Neoplatonism or, you know, a whole set of different philosophies that both give you this meditative, contemplative work to do, but then also teach you that, like, you know, you can understand this, you can get a grip on how things are, even though they're not at all like what they seem to be in the beginning. So that kind of satisfied my urge to like understand what is it all of these people are doing and like why are they doing it. And at that point I felt like, okay, I will actually just sit down and start practicing now, and sort of became a bit more serious about it. Did the retreats, did some other retreats, some online and some in person, and you know, had some experience of the things that are being taught. And that has been, yeah, it's been genuinely quite profound for me.
That's really fascinating. So in other words, the path to kind of deconstruct or undermine the naive realism is quite similar, But then in the wake of that deconstruction, what you erect in its place ends up being different depending on the lineage. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's fascinating because I've thought about this before, you know, when talking about postmodernism or deconstruction, that there can be a tendency to kind of leave you with the pieces after dismantling a conceptual framework or something like that. And to some degree, I see that also in Theravada Buddhism, which is that, yes, you pay attention to the phenomena and you pay attention to the three characteristics of impermanence, not self, and unsatisfactoriness. And yes, this does produce profound changes in your phenomenology, but then what comes after that? And I don't think I had a good guide to that, but now I'm starting to think that it's very controversial to talk about pre-normative or pre-sectarian Buddhism before the Pali Canon or something. But insofar as you can do it, that you can kind of potentially say that the most basic things are this practice of looking at the three characteristics in order to undermine the kind of naive realist view of the self. And once that illusion of the self starts to come a little bit unstable, then you can start practicing dependent origination. So what, I don't want to make like a strong claim that, yeah, this is the original Buddhism or something, because I actually am not all that interested in that question, because I'm not really interested in sort of these kind of textual debates, more as a matter of practice. And so I'm trying to think why to even specify that this is, I suppose it's just like a timeline kind of thing, like, you know, and also thinking in terms of my own knowledge, it's like, okay, once I understand that, then maybe the later stuff will make more sense. But of course, that might also be misguided, because some of the later paths or later lineages claim to be faster than the original one, right? Mm-hmm. And so it might not be the best thing to take my sometimes overly completionist approach to reading stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think this is true, but I think basically everybody claims that their method is the fastest. If you ask the Theravadan people, they will say, well, yeah, our method is the simplest. It's like, you know, kind of just, you know, really straightforward, quite austere, quite simple approach, and obviously that's the fastest. And if you go to the Vajrayana people, they'll say, we have hundreds of different practices, lots and lots of things. All of these were, you know, designed to, you know, get you to, you know, where you need to go as quickly as possible. And, you know, who can really know from the outside? I really don't feel at all qualified to judge those questions. I feel like it should be possible to resolve this in an empirical way. You know, if you've got a few hundred people, you know, and put them on one path, and you got another few hundred people and put them on another path, and you kind of like timed it to see how long it takes. But as far as I know, nobody has ever done this. And so the claims about which approach is faster or whatever, I just have to take it all with a pinch of salt. And I feel like these things have been around long enough that if one approach genuinely was so much better than another one, it would have outcompeted it in some meaningful way. And it doesn't seem that that's the case.
Right. And so it seems like there is value to each one. At the same time, I think you're pointing to something important related to the ideology point, which is that these things do change your view. And of course, if you change your view, it affects what you see, right? And so, you know, I've spoken on a recent podcast with Isabella about Althusser and his idea of ideologies, which is, you know, the strongest sign that you're in ideology is when you think you aren't, basically. And so, basically these do change your view. And if you say that they don't, or you say that this view is now more objective than the one you had before, it's kind of falling into this, I don't want to say dogmatism, but just, you know, it's failing to see how your view is affected by what you attend to, maybe.
Yeah. I think they are, they're not exactly equivalent, but I think that these are very much like related concepts.
Right. And so Yeah, tell me a little bit about your practice right now.
So I think that the main two things that I do at the moment are just standard shamatha, vipassana style. So doing a concentration meditation, then on reaching a certain level of concentration, going into an insight practice. That's again, it involves setting up the view as part of that, so that the view is often expressed metaphorically. So you might have something like an ocean of awareness. So there's a big emphasis on, and I think this is the like the big thing that you notice at first if you've done Theravada style meditation going into more of these kind of nature of mind, open awareness kinds of practices, is that they emphasize openness directly. So you go in and you establish an open, expansive view. You try and, even pay attention to your sort of peripheral vision. Really try and include as much as possible. Don't try and focus down on the breath at the tip of the nose or anything like that. And try to recognize the way in which this entire field of experience has things happening in it all over the place. There's body sensations and the sounds and there's the sight and there's interoceptions, there's thoughts, and in a way they're all just, you can just let them all happen. You don't need to fixate on them, you don't need to pay attention to them, you don't need to investigate them unless that's the particular purpose of the meditation you're doing. And you try to see like how much you can relax, like how much you can let that all be just happening. And the metaphors can kind of help with that. So you might say the mind is like the sky and thoughts are like cloud moving through the sky. And obviously we all know what the sky is like. The sky is just, it's just there and the clouds move through it. But at the end of the cloud moving through it, the sky is unaffected. So that can kind of get you the intuition for how you're meant to relate to things happening. Or you might say, the mental events are like waves in an ocean. And obviously you can't really say, well, that's a wave and that's the ocean. Like the wave is in the ocean. The ocean is sort of partly in the wave. The wave is a manifestation of the ocean. But, if you took the waves away and you had a perfectly still ocean, there would still be an ocean. So it kind of gets you at some of the intuitive ways that you can think of, I have this field of experience and I have things happening in it. What does any of this mean? And so a lot of my practice is just doing that kind of thing of really trying to sit with what's going on and then investigate aspects of the things that are going on. So, a thought arises, where does that thought go? A thought arises, where did that thought come from? A thought arises, where is it while it's happening? And then, you can ask other questions like, to whom is this thought appearing? And you can notice that in the absence of any thought, there's also an absence of anybody that it's appearing to. Like there's or an awareness of it being a thought that is happening to anyone in particular.
Yes.
So I know that you can get to that through dependent origination, but in this approach, you get to it by kind of subtly reifying the awareness as a thing. So you basically
Right.
sort of say, well, it's the awareness is aware, and the things themselves are expressions of the awareness. And you make that very, very slightly into a thing, while also recognizing that in doing so, you are conceptualizing it, and in doing, and the conceptualization is just a sort of a figment of your imagination,
Right.
and that practice basically, I think, is designed to get you to a place where you can, in ordinary states of consciousness, recognize the emptiness of things as they occur. Because it doesn't rely on jhanas or deep, super deep concentration. It's quite light, and it's something that you can do, in your regular day-to-day. You can drop into it quite easily.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. You mentioned the way that you can see that the self doesn't become reified in the absence of thought. And this is definitely something that comes up within dependent origination. So maybe it's worth saying a little bit about how that manifests, or I could say a little bit about dependent origination. Yeah, so dependent origination is a central doctrine within Buddhism. In the most commonly taught version of it, it has these 12 links. But I think it's important to say, first of all, that it has many versions throughout the suttas. And so it's almost like what dependent origination is like a methodology or a way of thinking about things that can produce frameworks. So it is not like itself a framework, it's like a way of looking at things. So, in other words, when we give this 12 link example of dependent origination that leads from ignorance to suffering, that's kind of like, you know what I mean? That explanation of here are these 12 things you can look at, that is not dependent origination itself. Dependent origination is somehow above that level. And one instantiation is this example. And then that example is itself a bit abstract, of course, because you're kind of going to have to use that technique in order to examine what's happened in a given situation. So I like to think of it that way, which is that there's a kind of like meta framework or something like that, a way of reasoning. And we were talking a little bit about different ways of attending the kind of right hemisphere, left hemisphere stuff from McGilchrist. And I think it is related to that. You know what I mean? Like you're not going to give a kind of schematic 12-step version of what the right hemisphere is doing, but you might be able to give an example through a kind of, a way you might look at it to kind of point the way. And so, dependent, this might all sound a bit abstract to someone who's never come across this topic. I ha will link to the article that I wrote about it that should make it a little bit easier. But if we think of it as, you could think of it as there being two orders of events. And one would be that a kind of forward order, let's say what we call the naive realist view, which is that an event has just happened and it's caused me to feel a certain way. So we can make it more concrete and say, I got an annoying email or something. And this email has annoyed me. Now, the meanness is important because when we're talking about dependent origination, it's kind of a pattern of suffering arising. And in order for there to be suffering under this description, and this is a little bit controversial, but there has to be a self view. That part not everyone agrees with, but I think let's just accept it for now, which is that if there is this feeling of suffering, there's also a sense of self that is suffering with alongside that. And so in the forward causal view, the order of events is I got an email, it was annoying inherently as a kind of characteristic of that email, and it annoyed me. And in this case, the me in the sentence is the pre-existing thing. And so, there's the order of events is like there's me minding my own business. The email comes in. The email is in like has this nature of annoyingness, and this annoyingness causes me to have this feeling. Now, in the dependent origination view, this is kind of backwards because in this understanding, and I think this is a little bit what you were pointing at, the sense of self doesn't actually arise until after the annoyance has happened. And so there's a kind of revisionary process where it appears that this thing has caused me to suffer. But in fact, it's more like the suffering has caused me to come into existence, which is like, yeah, that's the kind of, I don't know. Do you want to respond to that?
I mean, I have had that experience of, sort of chasing down really like that question of who is doing anything, who is experiencing anything, And coming to this point of realizing that every moment in which I think, well, it's me, that's a thought, like it's a self-referential thought. And it's the only evidence of me that I can have in that sense is the self-referential thought. And you take that self-referential thought away, and I'm not really aware of my own existence. I mean, like obviously there's a whole bunch of things going on that I can infer the existence of, like my physical body and, you know, things like that. But the felt sense of like I'm having an experience right now is tied to the specific experience. And in the absence of either the experience or in the absence of the identification of the experience with being it's happening to me, you don't really get the arising of that sense of self. That
yes,
that feeling of being the one to whom this is occurring.
The sense of mindness or
You can bring it up as well. You can deliberately then bring up, you know, what does it feel like? Me, mine, I'm here, you know, I've got, you know, like, you know, you can sort of bring up this feeling of, you know, kind of intentional, agentic kind of feeling, and then relax back out of that and then bring it up and then relax back just to get, just to be able to watch the process of it coming into being and going back out and coming in and going out.
Yes.
And you can do that in a kind of fairly direct way. It can also kind of happen to you sort of almost by accident. You can almost just sort of like go be sufficiently open in your attention to everything that sort of sense of self drops away, and you then notice that it's dropped away despite the fact that you weren't even really looking at it.
Yes, and it does seemingly take some practice to get there, because I think there is a kind of selection effect, which is that certainly speaking from my experience, the reified self was so frequent and persistent that I mistook it for kind of driving the action. Whereas with a bit of practice, you actually see that this thing that seems very important is actually a side effect. Like, I don't know. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it's just another thought you're having, like I am meditating. Well, that's just another thought. It doesn't necessarily mean that thought is like bad or wrong.
No,
it's just, in some senses, it's kind of redundant. It's a kind of unnecessary thought to be having. It's not solving a problem. It's not really doing anything for you. So it's habitual and you're doing it, but probably you don't need to be doing it as much as you are doing it, which is the, you know, the standard Buddhist case, I think, that people suffer because they have self-referential thoughts that they don't really need to be having.
Yes. And in this understanding, rather than the cycle of rebirth being about sort of multiple lives, there's some, you know, what I'm talking about is called the moment by moment interpretation of dependent origination. And in this understanding, when the Buddha talks about rebirth, it's actually talking, he actually mainly talks about birth. And the birth in this view is of self view. So basically it can happen many times a day or even many times a minute where a self view is born. And of course, then a lot of these things kind of make more sense about how you can, you know, it's not about being reincarnated into hell realms or into Deva realms or things like that, but more like, you know, your habitual thinking does condition you and set you up for these new cycles that are going to happen later in the day, let's say. And the other thing is, I don't want to go too deep on this, but it's in one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. I can put a link in the show notes if necessary, but it's just about the Buddha saying this generation, like not understanding dependent origination is the reason that this generation is subject to the cycles of rebirth. And it seems a very weird thing for him to say, if what he's talking about is reincarnation, why would you say that it's this generation is suffering from this? It seems like to me, what he's saying is this generation, because they're doing this pattern more quickly, this cycle of dependent origination, and they're getting stuck in this loop where the kind of output of one cycle results in another cycle of suffering, that's the kind of samsara, you know, this trap that he's talking about, which is a kind of vicious cycle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think it's easy once you've had that experience to see how that could be the case. Like once you recognize the difference between the two modes, really, like the difference between having that self-referential thought and not having it, it's quite profound feeling. Like you can see why people start religions off the back of this kind of thing. It's you know, it's pretty big. And I think to sort of connect this back to your thesis about the idea that these sorts of ideas have been independently rediscovered, I think you do see these ideas in a whole bunch of different places. They do turn up basically everywhere.
Yes.
With often different stories attached to them, different justifications or different explanations attached to them. So you see it in, you mentioned Ian McGilchrist earlier, and you know, he has a neuroscientific basis. He has a story about brain hemispheres, which I'm not qualified to judge the neuroscience, so it may well be a more scientifically accurate one than some other story might be. But phenomenologically, he's pointing at very much the same kinds of things, which is that you have one mode in which you are kind of serially orienting yourself to things one after another, and kind of getting pulled into deeper and deeper focus on aspects of those things, and potentially ruminating about them, or, you know, examining them more and more closely in the hope of understanding them more deeply. And you have another mode, which is a sort of open, expansive, inclusive mode, where you are able to hold many different things in attention at the same time, and, you know, even paradoxical things. So it seems like if you put all of these different things together, it's clear that the same thing is being talked about by lots of different people. And so it seems reasonable to say this is something fundamental to the human condition. It's something that we ought to be able to get at through cognitive science, as well as through philosophy and spirituality and the kind of traditional roots in.
Yes. And I love that you put it that way, because that is central to my sort of project, is seeing where this same pattern crops up. So the one between, you know, what Ian McGilchrist calls ways of attending, one which is, as you say, detailed, focused, tends to systematize and categorize, it's logical, it's more often linguistic, and it's kind of serial, as you were saying, it's like single-threaded, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas you've got this other mode, which is more expansive, holistic, takes in the big picture, maybe not in such a fine detail, and runs in parallel very fast. And so, you know, what I've just described is kind of the way that McGilchrist thinks respectively about the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And what I'm sort of saying about dependent origination is that it's always given, or in many of the sutras, I shouldn't say always, it's often given in both the forward direction, where you start with ignorance and you go through these different links that eventually lead to old age, suffering, and death. Mm-hmm. And then it's given also backwards. And apparently, Lee Brasington has said that in the earliest suttas, it's actually sometimes only given backwards. And so this suggests that there is a way to use that backwards knowledge to understand things. And just to sort of try to briefly summarize it, the naive realist view, the forward order causality of dependent origination, is like A causes B causes C. I got the email, it causes, you know, like there's me just existing, then the email comes, then the annoyance comes. Whereas the dependent origination view would say, well, if there has been suffering, we know that suffering has these conditions. And so we can reason backwards from that case to see what must have been in place. So you can kind of see these as like, okay, let's say I've got a baseball and I can throw it at a window and throw it at another window and throw it at another window, and each time the window breaks. And that establishes mm-hmm. a kind of understanding of forward causality. Now, it's yeah. a very different thing if I come into my house and the window is broken. Now, if there's a baseball, that might be a very simple story. But let's say there's not a baseball. Well, clearly something has happened here, but what? And the kind of reasoning that's required to kind of, it's always hypothesizing and then trying to differentiate among these stories. You could say that the first one of what happens if I throw this at a window is a kind of left hemisphere question. Whereas mm-hmm. what has happened to my window when I come in and find it this way is a kind of right hemisphere question. And yeah, I can talk more about that, but like you could almost see that the forward reasoning, mm-hmm. yeah, this is the same split is what I'm trying to point at. And then we can go into
I think it's important to be clear. This isn't just a sort of abstract philosophical question or a kind of spiritual thing. Like I recognize this from my work, for instance. So I work as a software engineer. And when you're writing code, you are very much in that closed, focused mode of attention. It's, as you say, it's linguistic. So you're thinking of, you know, symbolic manipulations. You are aware that you have this like very carefully constructed stack of abstractions, this sort of layering of abstractions and dependencies between them. And so when you're, you know, in the code editing a function or whatever, you've got your certain model of what that does, and you've got lots and lots of conceptualization about what's going on. You know, I've got a file, and then inside the file there is some data, and that data represents something. And so in order to get to something human meaningful, you've got to build it out of these like layers of abstraction that ultimately ground out in like, you know, the physical hardware. And you kind of need to have some awareness of what those things are, but actually you're doing most of the work is being done by encapsulation. So you're actually like, if I say I'm going to write that data to a file, I don't think about what the hell a file is. I don't think about what it really is. I just treat the conceptual as if it's completely real. And that's the only way you could ever get anything done as a software developer. So when you're going forward and you're writing the code, that you have to be in that mode. When you're debugging the code, then you have a problem. And often what you'll do when you know you've got something's broken, an error message has appeared. And often what you'll know this yourself, just in using software, you'll encounter an error message will come up, and the error message will be kind of weird and confusing. You'll be like, you know, I'm editing a spreadsheet, la 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 la, having, you know, like putting in my numbers. Then something comes up, you know, Windows system error, you know, there'll be some hexadecimal number, there'll be a, you know, subsystem file error, whatever. And you're like, I don't know what any of these things even are. And these things have emerged up from like, you know, 15 levels down the stack of abstraction with no way of them being handled by any of the higher level of abstractions. And so now it's just kind of being vomited up onto your screen as like an error message. And the job of the person who has to fix that bug is to work out like what level did that even come from? And like, how did it get there? And like, how did we fail to account for it in any of our other models in the system? And so you can do that. Actually, you can do that using both techniques. You can do it by like forensically, like a sort of, you know, the detective with his sort of magnifying glass following the trail of clues. And like, you start here and you work your way up. And that is using the sort of, you know, McGilchrist's kind of left brain kind of approach. What I always really enjoy, I mean, I'm kind of weird about this. I enjoy debugging software. I think most people like writing software more than they enjoy debugging it. And I'm the opposite. I like debugging it more than I like writing it. Because occasionally you get this just baffling situation where like, what the hell is going on here? Like how is it doing this? How is this even possible? And that's the point at which you have to make the intuitive leap. So you actually have to then use the, you know, right hemisphere kind of approach. You have to look at the system holistically and get a yes. feel. Well, this feels like one of those sorts of problems. I bet if we look over there, we're going to find something interesting. And It's just really fun to do it because when you do it, people think you're a wizard, and I
Because in
just
some sense you are.
well, I mean, for a brief second in that one moment, you're a wizard, and that's a really fun, enjoyable sensation to have, and that is the kind of right hemisphere the sort of way of thinking in McGilchrist's terms, and it. Is also in that sense, very easily to relate back to dependent origination because you're thinking like, what are the conditions that could have given rise to this? Like, what
Yes.
is necessary for, not ha why did this happen in a linear causal structure? Because you don't know, you haven't got that trail. You can't look at it.
Yes.
You have to ask, how could this have happened? You have to ask what conditions were necessary for this to have occurred, and in doing that, you then can narrow down and you can make these intuitive leaps and so on. So, people must be doing this all the time in their
Yes.
professional lives, not thinking that there's anything particularly special about it. What's interesting is the way in which in Buddhism these things are turned on our deepest assumptions about ourselves, our decent deepest assumptions about the world, our own kind of operation as beings, rather than on external things like computer systems that aren't behaving correctly or things like that.
Yes, and I love that example because, at the end of the day, when you say, well, how did you know that it was this in thing that you intuitively sensed it was, when you solved that problem, the answer is kind of just like experience. Like you can maybe think of a particular example where something similar happened, but in reality, it's not quite that because it's also the sum of knowing all the things that it wasn't and, all the places not to look. And so it's not this kind of, and that's where the wizardry comes in, right? Because there's not a kind of simple story or reductive story that says, well, A causes B causes C. And
But I
yeah,
want
so
to
I
pick
really
up
like that
here. You
example.
go straight to the wizard example, right? And that's what you think of as being what that relates to. I don't think that's a coincidence. Like it's like we associate wizards and sages and all of these kinds of figures with mystical knowledge. It seems like we on a cultural level we do know that there is this mode of thinking that we associate with a certain kind of person or a certain way of being that also has something to do with spiritual knowledge. And we just sort of like we kind of again like we kind of intuitively know that we don't have a good explanation for why that is so. We feel like, well, some people just have wisdom or some people just have really good intuition. And the idea that this is a thing that you can sit down and practice and get good at and develop a facility with isn't kind of widely believed.
Yes.
And even among spiritual practitioners, I think it's not necessarily clearly understood how that aspect of their lives connects to other aspects. And one explanation is maybe those connections are harder to make than it would seem, and that, being spiritually enlightened does not miraculously make you good at a whole bunch of other things, because in order to be able to debug the computer program, you do in fact need to spend ages learning how computers work and building up the intuition. But I do think there is a general purpose skill here that will be many people who can't access that, who don't know that that it's a move they can make, and they learn that move through spiritual practice, and then they learn that they can apply it in a whole bunch of other areas in their lives.
Yes, and I think that's an important point to make that what I'm interested in is the fact, this knowledge is esoteric in the sense that it's not widely known and it's not easily explained, but it's not actually inaccessible. It's not, I think you're right that it's linked to magic in some important way in what we think of as being magical. At the same time, there's this way in which it's not magical. It's actually something you could practice, right? Or it's not magical in the sense of like not possible or, sort of just luck of the draw because it can be improved through the kinds of practices that we're talking about.
I think I can, but I think It's the magic, I think, particularly comes from the fact that you can break categorical boundaries that other people thought were real. So other
Yes.
people are looking at the situation and they are tied into a particular conceptual framework. And your ability to step out of that conceptual framework and then perform some effective action that was just unavailable to them because of their concept seems magical. Like that is wizardry. Like that
Yes.
is kind of, Neo in the Matrix realizing that he can just take the bullets and they won't kill him. And it's completely like because everyone else thinks those bullets are going to kill you. And so that's how it works. And he realizes that that's not true. And so, like, I feel like that's the thing. Like that is the magic, is the ability to step outside of the conceptual framework and step into another one that is effective. Like you can't just step out of it and step into complete nonsense, because then you just kind of look kind of foolish. But if you can see some appropriate action that other people can't, because you are able to break out of the conceptual framing, that is going to look like a kind of magical act to most people.
Yes, totally agree. And this is one of my interests in it because this is a way of dismantling concepts, dismantling narratives, which I think is important to be able to do in order to switch narratives or switch concepts skillfully and to be able to improvise at sort of the right times, you know, when these narratives or concepts are failing. The point is certainly not to just dismantle everything and leave it that way. I'm quite wary of that. And then, as you say, you know, I think there's a kind of reactionary or there's a knee-jerk reaction, let's say, to this idea that, well, you can undermine the truth and create a new one. And people seem to think that, you know, they believe that this is sort of nihilistic or relativistic and that it's dangerous as a result, which in a certain sense, it is dangerous if you are in a position where you can create a worse narrative than the one that you've got. But that's not always the situation that we're in, right? Sometimes
There are
it.
definitely evil wizards out there.
Yes. That I wouldn't have put it that way, but that's a good way of thinking about it. Yes. And I suppose it is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used for all sorts of reasons, right? But yeah. I thought maybe we could go into a few other. Well, actually, first I wanted to say about the Buddhist conception, because there is some mention in the suttas that the Buddha had all these other kind of mundane insights or knowledge into the way things worked, but that he wouldn't share them because he felt that already it was so hard to grasp this thing that he was pointing at. He's like, I'm only doing suffering and the end of suffering. And, you know, if you get that, that's plenty. But it does, you know, as we were kind of alluding to, it does have broader implications that this learning this pr process. I don't know if you want to respond
I'm
to
curious
that.
about that because I'm not super familiar with the early Buddhist work. So that's the claim that, because I know there's a backward-looking kind of, retrospective thing that gets done later, where, from a standard Tibetan Buddhist point of view, there's the talk of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, where the early Buddhist work is essentially the first turning of the wheel, and then there is the second and third turnings, which are attributed to the Buddha. So they're attributed to, well, after he taught all of those things, he then came back and sort of, like for a select group of people, taught them this other stuff. And that's the stuff that we believe. And I have to presume that that didn't really happen the way they say it did, and that these are later innovations that then get attributed to the Buddha, because that's kind of how you had to do it. And those do seem to go more, they seem to become less of a via negativa. They seem to become more, there are more positive claims about how things really are. There is the claim about the kind of, like what's called a sort of storehouse consciousness, I think is the usual translation, which is sort of like, where do our habits and our framings come from? Where do they live? And there's also the idea of the Buddha nature, which is a sort of very controversial topic. It's a really controversial topic in Buddhism, because it in certain interpretations, it looks like a self. It looks like a, well, that's the thing that that you have that is not conditional on anything else. And so you do in fact have this unconditionally existing thing, which is your Buddha nature. And it's sort of, depending on how you teach it and how you learn it, it might begin to look somewhat heretical. And there have been lots of debates about that stuff. And there's also the whole tantric Buddhist history, where from their perspective, they have a critique of sutric Buddhism. They have a critique of the sort of the kind of thing that a typical Theravada practitioner is held to be doing, which is that they deconstruct everything and then they just sit there and they don't do anything. This is the people, they just disappear off into the forest and they meditate and they end their suffering and then they just don't do anything.
Right.
And that is seen as being, from the Mahayana point of view, that's seen as being selfish. Like that's like, well, you actually have a duty to help other people get enlightened. So if you're just going off into the forest and getting enlightened for your own benefit, that's really not, like, that's not part of the mission. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. So there is definitely a sort of whole series of engagements with the question of like a kind of normativity. Like, what should you do? Like, what positive actions should you be taking? How should you be engaging with the world from a position where you've had these realizations? So you're no longer, trapped on the wheel of samsara, but you nevertheless have to do things. You have to, and there are things maybe you should do that you're required to do. And that, I feel, is, that's the kind of stuff that, like, for instance, David Chapman talks about quite a lot. He has this very down-to-earth sort of way of talking about it, partly because it's clear that he's talking about his own practical experience of solving problems, doing things in the world. I think that for most people is going to be much more interesting, because it's going to be something that's applicable to them. It's going to be like, okay, yes, I want to end suffering. Yes, I want to, have a richer spiritual life, but I don't just want to sit and meditate for the rest of my life and do nothing else. I don't want to disappear into the forest. I do want, yes, to be an engaged person in the world.
Yes, and I think that's important. So that's kind of the distinction between the Theravada Arhant ideal, where you go off and get enlightened, versus the Bodhisattva ideal, where, mm-hmm, you forego that path of ending your own suffering in order to help others. And I think it raises all sorts of really important questions. I don't know if I'm sidestepping it, but I would just say, I don't think that the practice of dependent origination tends to undermine care for others. I think when it's used in the way that I understand it as being prescribed in the early suttas, it's like, when suffering happens, there's this kind of selfishness, right, of this mindness coming up. Mm. And here's a technique to see what conditions must have been met in order for this to be the current situation that we find ourselves in. By doing that practice, we kind of cease to reify these selfish stories. And the end result is, as I would see it, a kind of reduction in selfishness. Now, whether that ever ends in some kind of state, like, I'm not so interested in that question. I kind of see it as here's a technique. You may find it useful if you suffer. The opposite question, like, I think people, there's a tendency to go, well, what will the very end result of this process be, or this procedure, if taken on for years? Mm-hmm. Maybe it will be a kind of disengagement with the world, but typically that's not the immediate problem you face. It's a bit like saying, I don't want to run a marathon. I don't want to get off the couch because I don't want to become a marathon runner. It takes too much time, or something.
Yeah,
it's like, it's like a problem you encounter later on, potentially, if ever. And, mm-hmm, maybe just keep it into this meditation session for now. But I also think that this relates to my kind of overarching thing that I'm trying to argue about, neither nor, neither one, you know, as we've called the right hemisphere or the reverse order dependent origination, nor the kind of left hemisphere forward causality kind of thing is ever going to work on its own. And there are kind of warning signs when you go too far in either direction. And so in my understanding, and this is kind of my original editorializing, if what's happening is you are so deconceptualized that not only does mindness never arise, but no concepts ever arise, and you're off in on a mountain meditating somewhere, then it might be time to like reify some stories, basically.
Yeah, so,
yeah. I kind of don't see. Yeah. In my understanding, it's about skillful navigation. It's about improvisation, and maybe like you're saying, you know, there are times when you write the forward order code, and there's sometimes when you sit back and think, why am I writing this code? I've certainly had the experience of going into flow states while writing code for an hour or two, and then been like, wait a minute, I shouldn't have been doing that or whatever. Right. And so it's not a case that, well, you should always stay in one mode or the other. Kind of my whole point is to be able, while in one state, to get just that level of metacognition to be like, is this a good time to switch or not? But not really, so much that you're constantly doubting yourself, you know? And I haven't really thought too deeply on that, but you know, it's like you want to install this like check, but not have it constantly being triggered, you know?
So I think if we look into kind of our everyday experience, you know, as we're going through the day, we do flip between these modes of attention. And as you say, it's about having that metacognitive awareness of, well, what mode am I in right now? And is that the right mode? And do I want to go a little bit more this way or a little bit more that way? And also, you know, where is my attention on? Like, you know, what, you know, am I paying enough attention to my body? Am I paying enough attention to, you know, things that are going on around me? And kind of what, like how these two modes can interact is, I think, also really interesting. So you can recognize that you're trying to solve, you know, you're in problem solving mode, and you need that openness. You need to open, you're just like, this isn't working, I need a different perspective.
Yes.
You can also be in that open mode, like you encounter something, you think, I don't know what that is. And you might then want to go really analytical on it. You might be like, okay, I've just seen something there, and that seems new. That seems like a new idea. I'm going to like really focus in and try and figure out what's happening there. Those moves, like if they were physical moves and you could see people doing them, it would be really easy to see like who is moving gracefully between the two and who is just kind of like stuck in one or the other. And because we can't see other people doing it, and we can't really easily see ourselves doing it, it's kind of hard to know like what is going on for most people, like what is, you know, and it, even for yourself, like to remember, it takes practice to build the familiarity with those modes.
Yeah, exactly. And to know how to switch them and when to switch them, it is it's a matter of experience, I think, but I also want to suggest that it's neither just something that you kind of luck out and you are happen to be gifted with this ability. It is a matter of practice. At the same time, it's a matter of experience as well, right? It's not just a conceptual knowledge, even though I am going to talk about it using words, because that's one of the main tools we have when trying to convey things to each other. But I suppose what I'm saying is that conceptual knowledge is not enough. So, you know, we can kind of point to it using these abstractions, but then there's also going to be like a case of practicing it and experiencing it in our own lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where philosophy is both very interesting, but also has problems, where, you know, you can read a philosophical work that is talking about these kinds of issues. That is talking about the question of how do we know things and how do we understand things and how do we, you know, break and make categories. And I suddenly, this was my experience when when I was younger and reading these things, for the first time. I was assuming this is all forward, thinking, like this is all forward causation thinking. It didn't really occur to me that there was a different way of a different way of thinking about things. And partly this is just, actually in your teens, even in your early 20s, your brain is still developing. Like you don't actually really have the full capacity that you will have as a as an older adult. And I think, I know in some of your earlier conversations, you've had a critique of the way we interpret philosophy now as in a way that is almost kind of ignorant of these capacities. And we have even some of our sort of philosophical heroes are held up as models for how to think, but if you actually take them at face value, they're not telling you the full, they're not giving you the full range of potential that you have.
Right. And in particular, they often go into the concept reifying mode and the kind of analytical mode without giving you a good way to come out of that. But at the same time, I want to make clear, because I know people have had issues with my own issues with Socrates, that you might well live in a society, and I think Nietzsche and others have argued, I think McGilchrist is open to this idea too, that perhaps, the Homeric society is this extremely right brain, extremely open to experience, quite chaotic kind of phenomenology. And often the more skillful move is to go more towards the conceptual and think, well, how can we nail down this concept or something like that? So it may well be that that is the skillful move at that time, but it doesn't mean that it's always the right thing to do, right?
So again, it's a question of balance, or it's a question of appropriateness, perhaps rather than balance. So it was appropriate at that time for Socrates to make the interventions that he did, perhaps given the cultural background of the people that he was talking to. And maybe if he were alive today, he would not see that as being the appropriate move to make with the people who are that he would meet, because they would be very different from the people that he was meeting, over 2,000 years ago.
Precisely. And I like that you shied away from balance as well, because I think balance kind of suggests that, it's this kind of midpoint, or, there's a, that you could kind of get set the scales and just leave it. Whereas I think I like to think more in terms of like homeostasis, where you've got, your body's got doing all these complex processes, and there's both a sympathetic and a parasympathetic nervous system. They're both active systems, and they keep a kind of dynamic equilibrium through different stages of motion and activity and rest and things like that. So, the idea is not just, oh, well, we need to get these two things balanced, because that implies a kind of, stasis, right? And a kind of end state. Whereas I think it's much more like we're always going to be encountering new experiences. Experience never really repeats. And we're always going to need a skillful way to adapt to that. So it's more about becoming sort of adept in both directions than it is to kind of privilege one or to reach some kind of balance that we think we can just stay at, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely think of activities where I want to be extremely in one or the other. I don't want balance. I don't want to sit there kind of oscillating between the two. I want to know which one is appropriate and really go with that. But I want that to be happening because I was aware of a choice, and
Yes.
I made a decision to do it and felt in control of that happening, rather than feeling like it just happened to me. It was just I just woke up in a funny mood, and that was how it went. Whilst at the same time recognizing that there probably are all kinds of conditions that are necessary to be able to think in a certain kind of way. So maybe there are times when, if I've just had a cup of coffee, there's probably going to be it's probably going to be easier for me to do the focused mode than to do the
Yes.
open, things like that. But that feels like something that is can be generalized out of spiritual practice into all kinds of other domains of, in our lives.
Yes.
And I think you probably find for most people that they can recognize that distinction in some area of their life. Like you might have someone, for instance, who is very verbally fluent. Like they're really, you have a debate or a discussion with them, and they are in the world of ideas, they're able to both, you know, go right down into the detail on something and also jump around to, you know, reframe something and yet that same person can't dance.
Yes.
Not because of any physical difficulty with doing it, but they will be okay. Like, what do I do now? Should I be positively deciding to do something, or should I be open and reacting to what's happening on around me? When do I shift between those two things? Like, when do I reframe, and when do I stick with the frame? Those kinds of decisions you face in other areas of your life, and it just might not be as clear to you that there is a common factor between these different areas of your life where you face the same kinds of choices.
Yes.
And that feels like the thing that in the sort of the highest end of sort of achievement in Buddhism, I suppose, if you are a sort of fully enlightened Buddha, you're somebody who gets that. That is the sort of you recognize that everything you do involves a trade-off between conceptualizing and dissolving that conception. That in your speech, in your action, in your ethical decision-making, all of those things, they all have that trade-off, and they all have that ability to go one way or the other.
Yeah, I really love that. And it does relate directly to the kind of project that I'm undertaking. So yes, kind of starting with Buddhist dependent origination, I do want to talk about Neoplatonism. I'm quite curious to pick your brain about that, as well as Schopenhauer on time and space, as well as the historical and experimental sciences, because I think we can get some insights into each of these using this division. I don't know, is there somewhere you want to start? Or,
well, I mean, those are all things that I do not consider myself to be any kind of expert in. I think the Neoplatonism, the thing for me was that I was struck by reading Plotinus and reading the description that in the Enneads and reading the description of the meditative states that go along with their spiritual practice. And it's obviously not exactly the same as a Buddhist practice for perfectly good reasons, but there are lots of very recognizable things in there. And it proceeds toward an aim, which is henosis, which is union with the one. And so I'm gonna butcher the system completely here because I really do not have the level of expertise necessary to do this. But essentially, the one in, as I understand it, in Neoplatonism, is the, you know, sort of the highest principle. It's the highest thing, and it's the thing that cannot be bound by categories. It's the thing that is beyond categorization, and it's ineffable and uncountable, and all of those kinds of things. And in that sense, it has some similarity with the kind of nature of mind in Tibetan Buddhism. It's the sort of the thing beyond, the thing that has no boundaries, the thing that is beyond time and space, the thing that is silent but can be full of sound, and so on. And you know, when they say union with the one, I mean, this does sound like a sort of you know, it's a familiar meditative practice, a familiar outcome of meditative practice. It sounds like some kind of non-dualism, and that kind of reinforces the view for me that this is a common, that there are certain common factors here between these different traditions, and that points to something in our cognition, that points to something in the human condition, and that they have an explanation for it, which is derived from Plato, because Plato was the sort of preeminent philosopher of the time in which the Neoplatonists were writing. So they, Plato does have an idea, and again, I'm not a Plato scholar at all, so forgive any errors, but Plato does have a notion of where our concepts come from. He's very interested in that question of, like, how is it that we can have concepts that map onto reality at all? Why is this the case? Like, how this seems unlikely. How does this happen? And his explanation, and again, very loosely, involves the notion that all of the concepts that we have exist somewhere. They exist in the world of the forms, and that when we conceptualize about something, we are remembering a form that we have encountered before we were born. And I take that as a, you know, it's a story. I mean, it's an explanation, I guess, as good as any explanation as to where these things come from. But you tie that in with the meditation, and I think to me that sounds very much like what people are practically doing is they are meditating. They are experiencing the de-reification of their concepts. They are experiencing something like non-dual awareness, so meaning that instead of feeling like I am here, world is there, I am experiencing the world, you sort of feel like there is this field of you know, that contains all of these things, and one of those is the thing I would normally identify as myself, and like some body sensations and whatnot, but that is no different in kind to the tree I can see out of the window, and I can see the tree moving, and I can feel pins and needles in my foot, and that's that, like, in Tibetan Buddhism, the phrase for this is one taste. Like they both have the taste of emptiness. And so, you know, I'm going through, I'm having these experiences, my concepts begin to break down. I no longer feel identified with my body. So I feel like I have this new identity, which is perhaps an identity with everything. I feel like one with the universe kind of feeling. I think what they're doing there is they're saying, okay, well, that's henosis, that's union with the one. And what happens is you start to look at the world and you start to see new things that weren't there before. You start to see new patterns in things. Okay, well, if you're seeing new patterns in things, that they must have come from the world of the forms. So you have basically entered into, you know, through mystical practice, you've entered into contact with this world that you would otherwise, you've been cut off from since you were born. You encountered it before you were born, but you've now entered into contact with it, and that's enabled you to have a new idea. And you have a new concept, and that their explanation, you know, in line with Plato's philosophy, is that could only have come about through contact with the world of the forms. Again, I'm probably butchering this horribly, but it feels like a good sketch of how you could take mystical experience, of which has, you know, commonalities across traditions, then apply this, you know, Platonist view and use that to explain what's happening. What's really interesting is that then gets incorporated into Christianity. So henosis becomes theosis, and that becomes the primary kind of contemplative tradition, and still is the primary contemplative tradition, I believe, in Eastern Orthodoxy. And that that experience is explained as being union with the divine. And the fact that you no longer feel, the fact that you're aware of your body being present and things going on, but you no longer feel like you're making it happen, that's explained by the fact that the Holy Spirit is now making things happen. And that's that fits into the theology. What, again, I, like, I wouldn't take my armchair theorizing about this kind of stuff terribly seriously, but it feels like you can go a long way in explaining the kinds of experiences that people were having, and by looking at the known sets of spiritual experiences that it's possible to have, and looking at the philosophical or theological or cosmological kind of views that people had at that time, and see the tradition as being an attempt to explain the mystical experience with reference to those concepts. And I think this is important because we shouldn't pigeonhole that as just being a kind of woo-woo mystical experience. Like, this is in fact the stuff that makes up, you know, our everyday lives and our ability to be creative and our ability to respond to things in the world. So when we abandon those theological frameworks because they've got too much theology in them, we do run the risk of losing, with throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We lose the story that we were using to explain to ourselves how it's even possible to do that kind of reframing, how it's even possible to see the world in different ways and take an active role in reshaping our perception. And that is, I think that is something that is hard to explain, or has been hard to explain. And I think when people complain about a modern kind of secular materialist view of the world, they're not really talking about secularism or materialism. They're talking about the loss of those mechanisms for seeing the world in a different way. And it, when you tie in naive realism doesn't have any room in it for being able to see the world in a different way. Naive realism basically says the world, you see it just is the world as it is. Everything is just matter. And you don't really get to choose the meaning of things. That isn't how our perception works. Like, that just isn't. But just like scientifically, that is not how our perception works. Like, that's just terrible, terrible science and terrible philosophy if anybody were to actually hold it. So there is this room here for re-engaging with those ideas from a very scientific standpoint. Just like start with the cognitive science and go from there. And finding a way of telling people what is possible for them, making it real for them, without having to necessarily dredge up the old models, dredge up the religiously inspired models or the older philosophical ones. We could, in fact, do most of what we need to do just with a scientific framework.
Yes. Well, first of all, I love that. Thank you so much for describing your understanding of it. And it does line up with my understanding of what Plato is up to. And it makes it seem a lot more sane than I had kind of envisioned this idea of the realm of forms. Because if it is about, you know, by some kind of spiritual or mystical practice, you kind of open yourself, or, you know, in some cases, you may not even need the practice. You are opened by one experience or another to this new world. Then you think, well, where did the concepts in this new world come from? And they must have come from this pre-existing world of forms. That, to me, is a lot more appealing than the kind of ontological argument that there is, you know, there must be a realm of forms because of the order that we see, or something like that. And I think there are risks to this, because by saying these universals kind of pre-exist things, you can already start to feel kind of hierarchies of right and wrong come into this, mm-hmm. you know, as in, mm-hmm. well, I've been into the, you know, realm of forms this many times, and I know better than you do what the pre-existing mm-hmm. concepts are. Whereas the Buddhist kind of frame is not so... They have a much looser grip on concepts, right? This idea of expedient means, and you take the raft when you need to get across the river, but you don't take it with you everywhere you go. And I think there is some level of distrust in Buddhism of, you know, ultimate reality, ultimate concepts, you know, at least in mm-hmm. some parts of it. not quite as much as there is skepticism in Taoism, which is, you know, which really goes head on against concepts as pre-existing. It's fascinating. I mean, Charles Sanders Peirce writes about this, the American pragmatist philosopher from the 19th century. He thinks that the medieval scholastics do a much better job of understanding this whole debate, confusion from sort of Platonism on the one end, kind of what we're describing of there are, you know, there are these fully consistent concepts in this other realm, and we just recognize the kind of pale instantiations of them somehow. Mm. Or Peirce's own position, which is that these, even though there is no realm of forms, that there must be universals which inhere in the particulars. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to get this, you know, otherwise, he thinks science wouldn't work if there weren't universals. All the way over, there's another two kind of positions. One is conceptualism, which says that concepts exist, but only in the mind. And so we have these kind of what you might say are Platonic forms or idealized concepts, and we can share them between minds, but in fact, they don't exist out there. We only project them on, or we use them to order what we see from experience.
You mean that to say that the like if I was to point to a table and say that's a table, and you would agree that it's a table.
Yes.
Like the physical, we can agree that some physical object exists.
Yes.
And we can agree that we're both classifying it as a table. To me, that feels like that's a mental activity for both of us. I might point to something that is a borderline case, and you might in fact say, no, that's not a table. That is something else. And you might say it's a bench or something like that. I've never really had a good sense of what it would mean for the concept to exist independently of its use by people.
Yes.
That has never really made a whole lot of sense to me.
And I think that is the Platonist view, as I understand it, that there is some kind of pre-existence to these concepts. And which I agree with you.
Obviously latent. There's obviously a latent space of possibility where, you know, like, can you really say there was no such thing as a square before somebody drew out a square on a, you know, carved it into a piece of rock and gave it a name? Like, that doesn't seem right. It does seem right that the concept of a square exists, or a triangle. But I don't think it physically exists. I don't think it's inscribed anywhere into the fabric of reality. It's just the conditions exist for there to be triangles.
Yes.
And that... I think we could yes. speculate about that kind of thing for a long time.
Yeah, maybe let's leave that to one side. The most extreme view is called nominalism, which just says that the concepts don't even exist in our mind. They're just words, essentially. And so that's the kind of most extreme denial of the concept of universals, or the existence of universals, I guess I should say. But I do want to just at least touch on the Schopenhauer aspect, because it might mm-hmm. interest you. And hopefully we're not going so deep that we've lost people, but the,
we've either already lost them
or they're here to stay.
Yeah. So, either way.
Yeah. And, Schopenhauer, so I'm reading both volumes of The World as Will and Representation at once, which is not as weird as it sounds, because the second volume is kind of like a commentary on the first volume. And so there's mm-hmm. like all these sections where he's like expanding or extrapolating from what he said in the first volume. And one of the things that just absolutely arrested me when I was reading both of these, and I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly where they are, but if anyone's interested, please get in touch and I'll give you the exact references. But he's talking about the difference between intuition, which he associates with perception, versus rationality, which he associates with language. And so you can already kind of see this mm-hmm. kind of right mm-hmm. hemisphere, left hemisphere divide. And he says, look, all experience happens in the intuition. Basically, we have our perceptions coming in. It's ordered in space. It's always in space. It's actually not in time, he thinks. Like, it's a kind of late development that this time thing comes about. Mm-hmm. And so we enter the room, and the room is just immediately present. And every experience is unique, and it's always instantaneous and total and holistic, right? And this mm-hmm. all sounds very right hemisphere. Whereas the world of rationality is not like that. So rather than being presented instantly, it actually takes place over time. It is abstract, and he thinks that it is, so it's linked to time as well, which this is the part that like I really get a lot out of Schopenhauer, because he's kind of saying, look, if you can get really good at perception, and for him, this and perception and action are very linked. And so, you know, you could be a pool player that gets insanely good at mm-hmm. playing pool without any theory of what's going on. Like, you, it's mm-hmm. just
kind yeah, of yeah.
pure perception. But if you want to write a book about it, you've now got to do this extremely time consuming process of translating spatial things, which are always immediate and given an experience, into this ordered form that takes place in time. And he thinks that this is what we're always doing when we're speaking, you know, English mm-hmm. in particular, but for most languages, the word order matters, and it does mm-hmm. have to unfold in a kind of linear way through time, right?
Yeah.
And so he thinks like this act of writing the book is this long process of translation. And then once someone else takes the book and reads it, it's another act of translation to kind of take it from this one-dimensional, linear, time-based format and move it into a multi-dimensional, spatial, experiential, like, practice, basically. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of see, like, where this lines up with the dependent origination stuff. But to me, the idea that essentially space is kind of right hemisphere and time is left hemisphere. I don't know. I can't get it out of my head. I'd be very curious to hear what you make of it.
I mean, this does remind me of something. And obviously what it reminds me of a little bit is the more kind of imaginal is a possibly a term for it, practices. In particular, it reminds me somewhat of deity yoga or yidam practice, which is essentially the visualization of a deity figure, where that deity figure has a certain appearance. They obviously they have a name, they have an identity, they have a whole story that goes with them as to who they are, but they have a particular appearance. They might be sitting in a posture or standing in a posture. They might be wearing certain clothes or holding certain implements or having a particular facial expression or body posture that indicates an emotional state or indicates a stance or an attitude toward the world. And you visualize, so you sit in meditation and you visualize that that being, and you have to understand basically two things about them. One is that they are enlightened, they are a fully enlightened being. And secondly, you have to understand their expression, their manifestation. So you have to kind of hold these two things. And so you begin, I think, just by imagining, like in my experience, you begin by imagining being in their presence. They're sat opposite you, or they're in the room with you, as it were. And you have to use your imagination and use the facts that you know, the very specific attributes that they have. You use that to build a model of that being in front of you, as it were. And you have to contemplate their internal state. You have to contemplate that they are enlightened, so they have a fully open attention. They're able to take everything in, but they also have a stance, an attitude, a perspective on things. And that coming with that is, might be certain emotional, affective states. So they might be, for instance, Avalokiteshvara is the deity of compassion. So associated there will be feelings of compassion towards all beings, or towards perhaps beings in particular, if there are any other present. And as you imagine that, you're kind of imagining what it's like for them, what it's like to be them, perhaps their opposite you. So you begin to mirror them in your own posture, and you begin to take on more and more of the attributes of the deity. You begin to take on their perspective, their outlook, their way of being. And you absorb this more and more. In fact, in the visualization, you can imagine them collapsing down into a ball of light that's absorbed into you, or you can imagine the various ways in which their being becomes intermingled with your being. And you can be sitting there and then, fully experiencing compassion or determination or courage or whatever the kind of virtuous sort of feeling that they're having is. And it changes how you see the world. Now you're in a position where if you're doing, this kind of practice with Avalokiteshvara, and you contemplate someone you know who's maybe having a bad time, you will have strongly compassionate feelings towards that person, more so than you would normally. And so what this is doing is it's reorienting you towards, it's making salient other aspects of reality, and it's making available to you moves that were not normally available to you. So the move of being compassionate, like the move of like, I can help this person. Like, I've got it in me. I've got the capacity. And like, I am capable. And also I have like the reserves of compassion necessary to do this. In fact, as Avalokiteshvara, I have infinite compassion. So I have, enough compassion for everybody. And that to me is a practice it comes in two stages. So there's the creation stage and the completion stage. So the creation stage seems actually like quite a linear kind of forward progression of, contemplation of the specific attributes and building up 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 and building up, and building up until you've woven this whole sense of reality that's very, like, you've taken yourself all the way into this thing where reality is really, really different for you from how it was when you started. And the completion stage is essentially you dissolve this. The completion stage is you go out into fully open awareness. You drop it. You just drop everything. And you recognize that it's no longer present. In doing so, you recognize that you were not under the influence of an external deity figure. And then the way I was taught this is very explicit about this, like very matter of fact. Like there's a certain sacredness to the form, like that it deserves a certain amount of respect, but that respect is basically for its utility. It's done this way for a reason, but it's not like you're worshipping this being who lives in another dimension and who might punish you if you're disrespectful in some way. It's just that won't be as effective. And you recognize that all of the feelings that you had, all of the potential that you felt, all of the capacity to act that you felt is present within you. That was all you. You've always had those capacities. They've always been possible for you. They just weren't salient for you. That the move into that mode did not feel available to you in your ordinary state of consciousness. So now it does. Now that doesn't develop any practical skill. Like, it doesn't mean that you will actually be able to effectively help the person that you want to help. Like, you still need to become effective at doing the thing. But in terms of having the right demeanor, the right attitude, the right stance, the right outlook, the right perspective, that can be cultivated in that way. And so to the extent that there is a way of being a pool player, you could cultivate that through that kind of practice. And you could go from that linear, through that linear mode into inhabiting the right kind of outlook. And then you've actually got to play some pool and like learn to get good at it. But I think there's something that can be communicated in that way. It also depends on you being able to read in the right way. It depends on you being able to take that in, not as a set of sort of propositions about how a pool works, but as a way of being a pool player.
Yes, I love that. Because I think this is how I read, you know, it requires a lot of digestion, rumination. It's quite slow. It requires returning over and over again. And I think, and it requires kind of inhabiting a worldview. It's not that I, like, to me, I've always found it weird when people say they don't like a book because they disagreed about something. Whereas I'm like, well, that's not what, for me, the reason to read is to go into this other world that's like another mind that's done all this stuff and see what that world looks like and try that kind of, you know, pair of glasses on for size or something like that. And then just see what the effects of that are and then decide what to take or leave from that, that view. And I also liked, there's a few reasons I loved your example. One is the kind of religious pragmatism aspect, which is, you know, something that comes out of William James and things like that, which is this idea that, well, let's say prayer, you know, just in an empirical study just makes your life longer, makes you happier and all these other things. It's very hard to make a scientific case against why you shouldn't do that, basically, you know, that if it works, then just do that, you know. And I also, and of course, I'm a really big fan of Julian Jaynes and his understanding of what, you know, these God figures are. A kind of, they appear to you when you can't cope using your normal mechanisms, right? So let's say someone jumps out in front of a car or something, and we would get scared or become highly conscious and highly aware of what's going on. James would say that, like, you know, in the kind of bicameral consciousness, this would cause the appearance of a god. But there is, but in this, I think it's just reminding me because
people have lots of stories about this kind of thing.
Yes,
like, you know, they were in this difficult situation, they froze, and then something made them jump out of the way. I guess that was my guardian angel. You know, like that. That seems like, I don't know if that's statistically well attested enough, but like anecdotally, I've heard those kinds of stories, you know, like that is a thing that people talk about.
Yeah. So, and I think, again, we're still talking about the same thing that we brought up at the beginning, which is, you know, philosophy as a series of propositions versus a series of potentially perspective altering practices. And this ability to switch in order to produce a new phenomenological reality for ourselves, right? And the final, I just as a kind of teaser, or maybe I'll just mention that the last episode that I released with Isabella is about the difference between historical sciences and experimental sciences. So the question is, we're quite certain about certain aspects of physics where we've gotten this law. We're also quite certain of why the dinosaurs went extinct, but those two types of certainty are very different in the way that they're acquired. And one, let's say the physics way, kind of reasons from cause to effect. It takes a lot of specific examples in the form of experiments and reaches out for general laws, and it, I suppose, produces predictions about what will happen. So yeah, like cause to effect, but it's about more about the future. Whereas with the historical sciences, when we say, well, what, you know, did the dinosaurs go extinct all at once? And if so, what caused it? The again, it goes back to this detective reasoning versus this kind of causal reasoning that we talked about at the start. But you're reasoning from effects that you observe to causes. You're kind of tracing back from a general state of affairs to try and give a specific account. So it's kind of the opposite direction. And, you know, you're also reasoning about the past in general, basically. And so there is something about, you know, you could see kind of what I'm pushing at with the forward causality, you know, dependent origination in a certain direction, and it's A, B, C, D. And
yeah,
that story is true. But then when you unpick it and you see them rather than as causes, as conditions, it kind of fractally blows out in this way, because, you know, like, in order, Lee Brasington talks about this, which is like, you know, one of the conditions to die is to be born, right? Like, if you're not born, you can't die. But yeah, it would be wrong to say that birth causes death in any like straightforward way, right? And so there's like these two ways of seeing things. I mean it just goes back to, you know, some of the McGilchrist stuff that we've talked about, but it's like another instantiation. It's like, what if the way we do history is precisely opposite from the way that we do physics, and that this is related to these two modalities, you know?
I think it's interesting, because the question there in the difference there is that obviously with history, the past is a given. Like, what happened. Let's just take it as right that we know there were dinosaurs and we know that there are no dinosaurs now. So something must have happened, and we have to work out what happened. And in the beginning, we don't even know what the relevant facts are. Like, we just don't know. Like, I don't know the history of this, but I guess there was a sort of, I have a vague sense of a sort of 19th century period in which people were digging up dinosaur yes. bones and like trying to figure out, what does this tell us?
Cope and other people like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I guess over time, we've progressively refined our sense of like, what are the relevant scientific facts or laws or principles that might bear on this. So we've got better at carbon dating and things like that. That kind of excludes some possibility. It excludes the possibilities that the dinosaurs were running around 10,000 years ago. You know, yes. It excludes certain things. And so we can use that kind of logic, but only in an exclusive way. We can't use it to say, what question would we like to have asked had we been there? Like, yes. So in physics, we're always asking, like, well, what's the best way to ask the question in which we constrain the relevance right down, so that, like, you know, we eliminate all of these variables. And the only relevant thing is, like, what happens to this one variable? Whereas when we're looking at history, we can't do that. I imagine we could never be wholly certain. I think it's this, for the same reason that we can't be wholly certain about what's going on in reality right now. We don't have access to the data, and if we did, we wouldn't have the capacity to process it.
Yes.
So we can't work back through, you know, hundreds of millions of years of history. We just can't do it.
Exactly. And there's a kind of there's a problem on either end. As you say, we can never have total certainty of what caused the extinction of the dinosaurs, because we only have these kind of traces of what happened, and sometimes they're very sparse. At the same time, we can never have full confidence that the next physics experiment won't just undermine the laws of physics. That's the problem of induction, you know, from David mm-hmm. Hume, which is you never, like, we only get that certainty kind of like statistically, right? But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, there's no real guarantee. Like,
no, and I mean, at that point you get into simulation hypothesis, and what if it's all, you know, what if we're all just running on a computer somewhere?
Yes.
And, like, you know, how could you say that we're not? It would be,
yes,
it would be difficult.
But I think it's worth saying just a little bit about the dinosaurs, because in the 70s there were kind of like several ideas, and as you say, the technology developed and they basically were able to date things better, and they're like, yes, something did happen worldwide, and it was more to do with ammonites or something like that than the fossil record of the dinosaurs, I think. And what ended up happening is there were kind of like multiple competing stories. And I think this is really important too, because you're generating mm-hmm. these narratives and then you're trying to differentiate among them. And so
I have this notion that, like, did an asteroid kill the dinosaurs was like still a question that people debated when I was growing up in the 1980s.
Yes. Like that's when it was coming together.
There was definitely a feeling that it was probably an asteroid, whereas now I think that's regarded as being overwhelmingly likely.
Yes, because more and more evidence has come together about this shocked quartz that's all around the world. There's all these things, all these dates that line up that would just be, there's just no good explanation that would, you see what I mean? Like but what's interesting is the way that that search was organized as well. Cause just as you were saying, you know, physics is about taking elements of space and constraining them in such a way that you can repeat the same experiment across time, right? Mm-hmm. Over and over and over again. Whereas the historical reasoning is almost like you're generating these narratives and you're trying to differentiate them. Like in a way you're trying to fix time, right? But because you're trying to say what happened before what and these other things, but you're doing a search that can be quite wide in space, right? Mm-hmm. So there is something like deeply opposite about them. Carol Cleland, who I'm kind of relying on for some of this in philosophy of science, she sees it as to do with time zero, and there's like a causal asymmetry, and that these two ways of reasoning exploit the kind of overdetermination of causes by their effects. In other words, many causes have lots of effects. So like a single thing happens and it shows a bunch of evidence. This is what makes it hard to hide evidence that something has happened. Mm-hmm. But then any given effect is rarely overdetermined by its causes. So like it's rare for a single event to have multiple causes that are kind of in this linear fashion. Of course, there's
that loads each would of have conditions. Caused it independently.
Yeah.
So if something happened, there might be like four conditions that needed to occur, that needed to be in place for that effect to occur. So it has, yes. You could say it has four causes in a rough sense.
In a loose sense.
If any one of those did not hold, then the effect would not have occurred. So
exactly.
It's not,
so it's this difference it's between necessary and sufficient conditions, yeah. Right? There might be many necessary conditions, but none of them is sufficient in itself, or we would call it, you know, the only cause, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of like the few areas that I'm thinking about at the moment. I don't know if you have any questions or anywhere else you'd like to take it in the last few
minutes. Interesting. I do think there's something interesting to talk about in terms of kind of we kind of touched on it earlier, really, which is, you know, once you do these deconstructions of your perception, and you then need a new framing for what's going on, often people will take a religious framing because that's the one that is prevalent in their culture, or that's the one that was being taught to them in the context of the spiritual practice that they were doing. So in fact, they were doing the practice precisely in order to better realize that view of the world. And in principle, science ought to be an equivalent view. Like it ought to be possible to be scientific, to go through that process of deconstruction and then decide, well, you know, I now need to understand what's going on in the world. I need an epistemology. I need an ontology. I need an epistemology. I'm going to go to science. I'm going to try and get that from the best science I can. And there's an interesting question there about whether or not science, like how easy that is to do, like on a practical level, because science is changing, it doesn't always provide you with the kind of stability that a religious framework would do. You know, like you can get good at teaching people dependent origination because you have a couple of thousand years to do it. If you got good at teaching people a worldview based in Newtonian mechanics, it wouldn't be that long from the point at which you got good at it to the point at which that was no longer it was no longer possible for people to align their perceptions to it, like
yes.
to intuitively grasp a sort of a Newtonian way of seeing things. So there's some kind of interesting question there about the limits of, like, the role of science. Like, is science always going to be kind of in that sense that Schopenhauer was talking about, this slow, linear, linguistic, formal process? Or do we ever get to the point where, our perceptions are actually just truer than our older perceptions were because we are exposed to a scientific worldview. And what are the pitfalls? Because I do feel like the kind of the spiritual malaise that people bring up in relation to, you know, there's a bundle of words in there, like things like materialism, or they'll say, you know, the meaningless of the, you know, the scientific worldview, it has no place for meaning in it, you know, which I just don't agree with, because I think that's based on science as it's taught up until about the age of 16 or 18. Like,
yes.
Yeah, I agree. Like a Newtonian billiard ball universe kind of is sort of fairly meaningless. But that's not what our best science teaches us. But when we try to give people a scientific worldview, they come out with this horrifying thing that seems to be like spiritually bad for them. And so I'm interested in this question of like, how do we get a scientific worldview that isn't a set of scientific facts, that isn't like, you know, I'm scientific because I agree that the speed of light is whatever it is, or I agree that, you know, I agree with the second law of thermodynamics or something.
Yes.
Like that's not what makes someone scientific. So is there a synthesis here of like the scientific attitude, the scientific stance, the stance of thinking in that way? And would it make sense to teach that to everybody, or would that make sense only for scientists to do it? And
it's a great question, and I'm glad you bring up science, because I'm certainly not anti-scientific, and I think that the true, you know, the kind of endeavor of science to discover regularities in nature is super important. I do have a kind of reaction against what Wittgenstein called scientism, which is taking some of the trappings of science and its outward forms to kind of, and indeed its successes, you know, in terms of physical changes in the world, in order to push a specific ideological program or something like that. Now, and then the question that you're asking about meaning, I mean, Thomas Kuhn is quite clear about this, that, you know, when science is functioning normally, it doesn't ask the big questions. And when it starts to run into problems, that's when philosophers start coming back into the picture, that basically science almost resorts to philosophy when it can't answer the questions, you know, like when there comes to be a scientific crisis. So it'd be an interesting thing to think about. And it's one that I've thought about, which is maybe the kind of switching that you and I are talking about to do with, you know, left brain, right brain, ways of attending, dividing up the world into categories versus throwing away those concepts and seeing the world anew, as we have been talking about in our personal lives, are actually what's being done at the societal scale between science and philosophy, which is to say that when science is functioning normally, it tends to carve the world up and categorize it. And when those categories start to fail it, then it does this big crisis switch mode and comes up with like a new paradigm, you know?
Yeah, I feel like I think the interesting thing for me in this is one of a kind of philosophy of science, because I think the effectiveness of science, like the instrumental effectiveness of science at any given point, can vary in the sense that, like, you know, how much can you feel the benefit of science? Like, so at different points in the last kind of, you know, couple of hundred years, you could attribute to science like real meaningful changes in your life, and you could see science itself as a force that had you know remade the world in some way, and that's a very sort of instrumental way of relating to what science is. It's just science is that thing that extends our capacities, and we're happy to have it extend our capacities when it's doing that well, and if it looks like it's kind of slowing down or you know, taking us in a direction we don't want to go, then we want to start philosophizing about it. I don't think that's necessarily what Kuhn was getting at, though. So I might have taken that off in the wrong direction. The thing that concerns me, it is with the way that science is taught, because certainly the way that science was taught to me, and I think to a lot of other people, was not so much in the form of actual science lessons in school, but the prevailing sort of idea was that it was good to be scientific. Being scientific was just like about being right about things, and
Yes.
being unscientific, unscientific people are like they're religious people, or they don't believe in Darwinism, they're creationists, and so it was seen as a kind of almost like a clash of belief systems. It was like a
Yes.
clash of systems for organizing society. And in order to like simplify science, in order to make science a kind of seem like a workable means of organizing society, it kind of got turned into this thing that was going to present us with a set of truths, rather than with a method or with a even not even a method, but rather a perspective on things, a way of being scientific.
Yes.
And that I think has been very damaging, because it's taught people a bunch of stuff that isn't true. Like if you actually wanted to teach people the true scientific conclusions, it would be baffling. It would be, I mean, like if you try to teach the best physics that we have, it's actually really hard to understand. Like the best physics that we have is like really complicated and counterintuitive, and famously, hard to agree about even among the best physicists. So if you wanted to teach people like what is the state of the art in physics, like what do we actually know, you'd be teaching them all of this completely incomprehensible stuff that they couldn't possibly like it's not that they couldn't understand it, but it wouldn't make sense for everybody to have to understand that. Like it
Yes.
couldn't be useful for everybody. So
And
we
this
then
in, yeah, go on, sorry.
well you know so we then simplify it. We then sort of teach a sort of quasi-Newtonian kind of simple model of how things work, because you have to, and Newtonian mechanics is good enough for moon landing, so it's probably good enough for practical purposes. But it does present everything as being a kind of closed book. It presents it as like this is the truth. We know it's the truth because scientists figured it out, and scientists are just kind of special geniuses who are able to do this. And
Yes.
so, and you're not a special genius, so don't think about questioning it. And I'm not saying
Which
that
at the end of
anybody
the day is a,
explicitly.
at the end of the day, that's a form of dogmatism, right?
It is. And I don't think anybody explicitly teaches this. Like I'm sure science teachers would be horrified at the notion that that's what they're teaching people. I don't think they are, but I think that's a sort of prevailing cultural norm that we have, that this is how it works.
Yes.
And I do think it's bad because it teaches people a bunch of things that are not true, and it's also bad because it fails to teach the attitude of a scientist, the attitude of a person who is not ignorant of, like a person who has the appropriate level of certainty about what it is they do or do not know, and
Yes.
the appropriate level of capacity to make or break their conceptual frames when they encounter things that don't fit with their existing model.
Yes. And I think this, in many ways, we're still living in the kind of aftermath of the Draper White stuff from the States in the 1880s, this conflict hypothesis, which was a kind of, it's a relatively recent idea, 100 something years old, that science and religion are fundamentally at odds with each other. As you know, it's most scientists for most of the time were pretty religious. The idea that they weren't or were forced to say they were Christian, or that they would have thought otherwise if they were living today or something like that, is kind of a new atheist position. That's quite it's very new. And I think that the conflict thesis is coming under greater scrutiny. There's being books being written about it. Even in the early 20th century, it was not particularly tenable among historians. They were like, this is just not the case that science and religion are at odds. But I think that one of the effects of that, the very popularity of that view, was to kind of almost, you know, there's first this assumption that what Christianity is about is a set of propositions or beliefs, which, to be fair, you know, it's had creeds since the beginning that do make it seem like belief is very important. But to some degree, that sidelined a lot of the practices that you were talking about, which were maybe one of the reasons that Christianity might have gotten so popular in the first place, is because it did practical things that practically worked for people rather than being a set of abstract propositions. And then by extension, by saying, well, science is opposed to Christianity, then it too must have a series of beliefs rather than, you know, like I would be very comfortable saying, you know, Christianity is this set of practices and you do this and you don't do that. And science is this set of practices and you do this, and you don't do that. Once you get into the territory about like, well, you know, Christians believe this or science believes that, I'm like much less comfortable with the debate because I'm like, well, in an ideal world, you know, I'm not saying in an ideal world, but like you could argue that, you know, there's a kind of humility that comes out of the Christian worldview that might say, well, there's just some things that we don't understand. We may believe this, and, you know, and a kind of humility that comes out of science as well, that we're always going to have to defer to evidence and experience, and that we can't expect that always to come out in the way that we want it to. And so, you know, like in a certain sense, beliefs may be useful for organizing society or action or investigation of nature or even doing spiritual practices, but are they the core of either worldview? You know what I mean? Like, or either endeavor, I would rather say, than worldview.
Yeah. And I think I think that clash thesis is in popular culture is still very much alive.
Yes.
Like that. Agreed. It was there around the whole kind of new atheist movement 20 years ago. The way people would talk about, you know, very, and I get it. I mean, I think if a religious person is coming along and pushing a particular belief and saying, well, this belief, this kind of truth claim is true because it's in my scripture, I think you're completely entitled to say, no, I'm just not going to accept that. But I think the way in which people talked about religious people was as if they were just simply mentally deficient, like,
yes,
like not capable of accepting the obvious truth, even when it's being presented to them. My God, what is wrong with these people? And I think that missed out completely the fact that there must be something happening here that is making this real for people. Like, yes, the experience that people are saying they're having of God, like, there must be something that is happening in that person's life that is making that real.
Yes.
And I think, you know, a good cognitive science would recognize that those kinds of experiences are completely reasonable. Like they are, you know, they are experiences that people are going to have. It makes a lot of sense that they have them.
Yes.
And it even makes a lot of sense that they should organize a religion around the having of those kinds of experiences. That seems like actually a pretty good idea. There are failure modes for religions, just like there are for many other things. But that the idea that religion was a sort of superstition that we were going to grow out of, I think, was not a great way of seeing things. I actually have this is very dumb, very silly, but I just love it so much because it's a great encapsulation. Back in the late 1970s, I think. So I watched this when I was a kid. This was an animated film from the late 1970s called The Flight of Dragons. And it's all kind of swords and sorcery kind of thing. In fact, I think even... I think the lead character is meant to be like a D&D player or something like that. There's this, I forget the precise details. But the upshot is a modern American... intelligent gentleman of the name of Peter Dickinson is by magical means transported into a world of magic. And here he meets, you know, various wizards, and they explain that, you know, the world of magic is undergoing some kind of problem. And I forget the precise details. And it's it, the blame can all be laid upon an evil wizard, the evil wizard Omadon, who's played by James Earl Jones, who hams it up amazingly. Like, the film is not great, but he really gives it all he's got there. And the characters go off, and they're going to go and confront the evil wizard. And the upshot is the final confrontation between the evil wizard and the scientist Peter Dickinson. And Peter Dickinson, you know, he says, I deny your magic. And the wizard said, well, if you deny me, you must deny all magic. And he said, oh, very well then, I deny all magic. And so the evil wizard is like, well, deny this, and proceeds to, like, you know, utter a bunch of mumbo jumbo, and like dragons sprout out of his back, and like, you know, he's clearly about to like unleash, you know, great magical forces. And Peter Dickinson says, well, I have some magical spells of my own, and proceeds to recite like sort of high school textbook level, like the speed of light in a vacuum is blah, blah, blah. And every time he says one of the dragon's heads explodes. So like, you know, he even quotes Darwin, and he's got, I think that's probably the second law of thermodynamics is in there, or wow, something like that. With each one, you know, the dragon's head explodes, and then finally the wizard dies. And so he's defeated by the recitation of a bunch of like propositions. He's not defeated by the scientific worldview. He's not defeated by the attitude. The character does not engage in any actual scientific problem solving or reasoning about anything at all. He just memorized these.
They're just incantations, like, right? Just like the magic.
Yeah. And that, like, so that's what you could show to kids in animated films in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And so it's not surprising that people grow up with the view that that's what science is.
Yes.
Like that's the presentation, that's what it is to be scientific, as distinct from magical.
Yes.
Because you just have better spells than the other side do, which is not really very, not an accurate representation of what science is. If anybody wants to watch that, by the way, it is on YouTube. If you search The Flight of Dragons final scene, you will be able to watch it.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a good place to leave it. I mean, I think just, yeah, it's like, the conflict is actually between cod science and cod religion. It's actually not really.
Yeah, it's kind of like everybody's idiots, and we're just sort of standing on the sidelines, just bearing over everything.
Thanks so much, Rob. This has been amazing, and would love to have you on again if you're up for it to continue.
Yeah, very much so. I really enjoyed it, and I think there's definitely places we could go with some of these ideas.
Thanks so much. Is there anywhere you'd like to point people, or? Don't need to if you don't want to.
No, I'm in the sort of like phase of trying to get into writing again, and can't quite seem to force myself to finish anything. I can start lots of things, but I can't seem to force myself to finish anything. So hopefully I will be able to write something. Maybe I will try and take some inspiration from our conversation.
Yes, that would be amazing. And feel free to share that with me, and I'll put it onto the show notes. Thanks so much, Rob. Let's talk
awesome.
Soon.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/BrianCam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.